Hurricane Hector is flirting with our southeast shores. You might be thinking just what we need, the threat of another natural disaster. It was just last week that Governor David Ige extended a lava disaster declaration for the Big Island for a third time. Other communities have yet to recover from flash flooding. So how are our weather-weary coping? We sat down with Child and Family Service President and CEO Karen Tam to talk about how we're supporting our community's mental health needs.
This is an unending, it feels like an unending process. And, you know, you really feel for the families, the, you know, the impact of the volcano, the impact for the children. And so one of the things that we've done is taking just that proactive approach and creating those Ohana kits, which are backpacks full of coloring books and journals and information on how to watch for, you know, possibilities of mental health issues coming up. Anything that we can do to help people focus on the mental health, even though right now the focus obviously is where are they going to live and where are they going to sleep, but also there's that whole mental health side of things that we want to help families to pay attention to.
Now, I know when this first happened, this latest phase, there were lots of folks that came from the neighbor islands and the mainland to help out. Where are we at with that right now?
You know, I mean, I think that's very typical when something first happens, right? You have a lot of people who are wanting to help. But I think yesterday I had a conversation with our team over in Hilo, and there is, you know, the idea that there is still some ongoing services, but, you know, slowly people are getting back to what they were doing before, and so not as much is available, and reasonably so. You know, some families have found housing and such, but the shelters are still there, and there are still families living in the shelter. They've been homeless since it started, and so the needs are still there.
I know there was talk about maybe setting up a fund so that if folks needed to fly to Oahu or another island from the Big Island to stay with relatives because housing is limited on the Big Island, that was something that was in play. I don't know where
we're at. So, you know, First Hawaiian Bank was the first to step up to do that, which is amazing. And what they did is they said, let us help. And in partnership with others, we have been able to fly some people, mostly to the mainland, actually. And what we try to do is really assess where is their best place for permanent housing. And a lot of the families say it's back to family on the mainland or where they have family on the mainland and not necessarily another island because it's expensive to start over here in the islands. And so what we've seen is families moving, and not just to Vegas. You would think, oh, they're all moving to Vegas. No, they're moving all over the West Coast and even into the Midwest, wherever they have connections and resources to start over.
So are a lot of those folks then transplants?
Not necessarily. They just happen to have family in areas that they can go to. And so, but then, you know, I've heard some stories where people had just moved here from the mainland, bought their house, hadn't even really been situated, and now their house doesn't exist anymore. And so what do we do, you know? And so those families obviously are getting help to move back.
What are we doing at the shelters?
So the shelters, you know, I think the focus at this point is really helping families find the permanent housing. But in the meantime, you want to keep their spirits lifted, right? So one of the things that we've done is try to offer some classes and, like, you know, Zumba or other things to get the energy going, and also just providing those mental health and support services where we can. And so really connecting families. But it is a tough situation, and so we want to keep the spirits lifted and let the families know that there's options out there for them.
And the new school year is also starting.
Yes. And so, you know, one of the things I was saying the other day is that we really need to see how we can get some mental health services in the schools as the kids are coming back together. It's really can be healing when you are talking as a kid to another kid, maybe having experienced the same thing. And so, you know, one of the things we're looking at is how can we support that and get into the schools and work with the kids. I'm sure the teachers will do that naturally, but sometimes it's helpful to have mental health professionals as well from outside come in and really talk with the kids. And so that's going to be happening, hopefully.
I know that there has been some discussion on the part of the Department of Health and the Department of Education about the emissions, the VOG, and how that impacts, you know, our community as the kids start to go back to school again.
Yeah. We've, you know, even in our employees, we have seen an increase in calling out sick because of the breathing issues and the burning of the eyes. Even in our Kona side offices, just an incredible challenge to breathe fresh and clean air and how that's impacting the community. And I would say that that can just create a real frustration and a depression in the community as a whole, as they're trying to just get healthy air. And so, you know, one of the things we're doing as an organization is kind of assessing what can we do to help clean the air, at least in our environment where we bring people in. So installing air conditioners where we never had them, or air filters. But this is an ongoing issue. And so what does that do for the community and for these kids going into an environment where they're trying to learn, but their eyes are burning and their ears are hurting and they're breathing? It is a challenge. Yeah.
I know HCA said that they will be starting to survey residents and folks on the Big Island because of the downturn. You know, they're a little concerned about that. What are you hearing out in the field about that?
Yeah, there's definitely concern that the whole, you know, with the decrease in tourism, the impact on the community, not just those that are impacted by their houses burning and not having their homes, but also the whole community. And so, you know, where some people might be losing their jobs because the hotels aren't as full across the whole island. So the idea of this ongoing natural disaster impacting a community as a whole, it can be really challenging. And I think of like when you're having something going on in your life, you can turn to someone who maybe isn't experiencing it and they can help to lift you up. But in this community, I can imagine that everyone's struggling. Everyone's struggling with breathing quality and other areas, and maybe losing jobs or having less hours to work. And so it's really about impacting the whole community. And so we need to make sure that we offer support to the whole community to help them, you know, survive this ongoing disaster.
There is a cross-section of agricultural workers who found themselves out of jobs because all the papaya fields have been inundated. Lots of different farmers affected. And so those workers, we were told, are looking for work elsewhere. They're moving up the Hamakua coast. But then there's also the stress of that.
Yes. It's like another relocation, right? So you're bringing your kids, your family, in an unplanned move, not something you want to do, but you have to do for your family. And what does that do, and where do you go, and how does that impact the kids? You know, and children, they react in so many different ways. Some might be really resilient, and it doesn't impact them at all. They're just excited. They see it as an adventure. But others may become angry, and others may cry and be depressed and miss their friends. And so, you know, our hope is that families pay attention to that and they're talking about it, making sure that they're having opportunity to share what they're feeling and understand that all of those moves, all of those transitions impact everyone in their own way, and making sure that they're paying attention to that.
And as far as coping skills, I mean, we all, I think, want to be able to be resilient and raise children that can bounce back, and even with adults, you know, you like to think that you're resilient and you can bounce back, but sometimes this goes on for a while, you know, you do get tired.
Oh yeah. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it feels like to have it have gone on as long as it has. And so I think really taking breaks, journaling is one way that some people find helpful. Certainly finding an exercise class or some way to get your endorphins going to lift your spirits. I think families on the Big Island really have to be very purposeful about lifting those spirits and helping each other in this time. And so anything they can do to create that, you know, sense of positivity is good. But it is real and it is ongoing, and some will struggle. And so that's why there's therapists and others out there that can help them.
The loss of the recreational area, I think, too, in talking to the scientists, and they lament, oh, it was just a wonderful ecosystem there. And it just was a wonderful resource. And now, you know, there aren't many places like that on the Big Island, or you have to drive far to go to them. So that's a whole nother loss that the community has to process.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because we all have those areas that we're fond of. We grew up going to certain beaches, and so there is that loss. And so where do they go? If that was the one place that they found was the, you know, the most enjoyable place they would go every weekend to get their energy back, then it's trying to find those other locations and other places. And so that was really sad when I heard that that had happened, because I know that was really utilized by the community that's impacted. And so it's difficult.
And I know you had mentioned that there were a number of private entities that stepped up. You said First Hawaiian Bank. There were a number of foundations. What about federal money? Have we been able to tap into anything that would help kind of stretch our dollars?
You know, not at this time for our organization, but I know FEMA has been on ground trying to get money out right to the families, which I think has been great. And so that's where the focus has been for the federal money. But I know that, you know, they are looking at how can they bring federal money in to help. And I think it's really important for all of us to kind of pause, take a moment to look and plan and have a real good assessment of what the needs are. So we're not just throwing things at the community. What is it that they want? What is it they need? And then responding accordingly. And so that's what I'm hoping will happen at this point.
And what about our caregivers, like the folks that you have on the ground that are listening to the stories and providing therapy for these affected victims?
Yeah, so in our field, we call that vicarious trauma. So it's experiencing the trauma through someone else's story. And so we, as an organization, really do a lot to help take care of our caregivers, to those who are listening to the stories. And so what I always say to them is, if you need a break, take a break. If you need some time off, if you need to go to a neighbor island, if you, you know, need to breathe some fresh air, whatever it takes, we want to make sure that you're healthy so you can help others. And so we always pay attention to that. It can be really weighing on those that are helping as well.
And I'm not sure if you're helping also with the folks on Kauai, because I know that community got the brunt of the floods, and then
yes,
the lava happened, and then a lot of the attention shifted. But there are folks on Kauai and also here on Oahu who are still homeless,
yes,
because of those floods.
Yes, actually, the Hawaii Community Foundation has given us a grant, and we are providing counseling and support and case management for families on Kauai as well. And it was like the perfect storm. I mean, everything happening at once, and you feel for the Kauai community because the attention went to the Big Island. But there's a lot going on and healing going on over there as well. I believe the roads are going to be opening up soon if they're not already open, and that's going to be helping the community. But we've been right out there in the community helping families, and it's been really hard to hear the stories of that horrific flood as well.
There are limited funds. There are probably other nonprofits who may be seeing less money come in.
Oh, yeah, because the money always comes from one, right? So you have to kind of take from one to pay for the needs that are current or more important at the time. And so I haven't heard anything at this point, but I'm sure that there's, you know, restrictions to some funding as the money is going towards the immediate needs on the Big Island and Kauai. You know, people often say to me as I'm talking to them, well, how can we get involved? How can we help? And I think it's important for the Big Island and for Kauai for people to understand that this is not a short-term thing. It's taking time to heal. Even on Kauai, it's taking a long time. And so let's not forget, you know, let's, as a community in Hawaii, we're all ohana. So let's work together. Let's make sure that we continue to care for our community. And so where people can dig and give some funds to help with services, that's great, but don't forget that there's also still needs. And so if you're wanting to volunteer or help in other ways, that is still needed. And, you know, it's easy to move on because other things happen, but this is still real, and we want to make sure that we don't forget and we keep being as a community there for each other.
All right. Karen Tan, thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Karen Tan, president of Child and Family Service, talking about meeting the mental health needs of our communities during long-term disasters. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Stay tuned. Your backyard quiz is next. Unihua.
kaua o ahu o molokai o lanai o mau o kahoʻolawe o Hawaii.
Coming up in the program, we'll be exploring the struggles of Hawaii's Republican Party. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking back at a time in history when Republicans had a more widespread role in local government. We're thinking of a figure who left his imprint on 20th century Hawaii. He was born in Maine in 1871. He had traveled widely before coming to the islands and accepting an offer to become the editor of the Honolulu Advertiser. After 3 years, he crossed the street and took over the helm of the Honolulu Star Bulletin. His journalistic career fueled his interest in local politics. He ran for mayor of Honolulu and won. His fortunes took a turn, a good one, in 1915 when he brought Warren Harding to Honolulu, then a Republican senator from Ohio. Our mystery man introduced Warren to members of Honolulu's ad club as the future president of the United States. Harding responded by promising to appoint the then mayor as territorial governor if he ever did become president. 3 months after being sworn in as president, that's just what Harding did, naming this historical politician as the sixth territorial governor of Hawaii. He served from 1921 to 1929, and today we're looking for his full name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. We are counting the days to the primary election. It's this Saturday, folks. Our contributing editor, Neil Milner, is in studio this morning to talk about the grand old party. Hi there.
Hi. Grand old party, yes.
Yes. So how do you think we're going to do here?
You mean the grand old party?
Yes.
Well, I don't think the grand old party is going to do much worse than they've done over the past 50 years, but they're not going to do much better as far as I can see. And there are basic reasons for that that have little to do, and that's why they're so basic, with the nature of the candidates or the nature of the kind of everyday political campaigning that there exists. Just to make sure, it's pretty likely, it's almost certain that the national offices, our Senate race and our two congressional races, are certainly going to be Democratic. There's a very good chance the governorship will be. And there's a very good chance that Republicans won't increase the minuscule number of seats they have in the state legislature.
Right. They might lose ground.
There's no you can't really make a compelling case that they're going to go up. So the real question is that I've always been interested in is why. And I think that people have to understand the basic reasons for why that's the case.
And, just recently, I know we've had a situation where the Republican Party disowned a candidate. We have another one where her status is in question about whether she's a legit candidate to run. So there are all these things that are swirling just in the weeks before the election.
Yeah, you know what? They're swirling. It's like, to use a bad metaphor, it's like if there's a tornado hitting and there's a few pieces of paper swirling around. That's the paper. Here's what the tornado is. Here's why the Republicans have these problems and will continue to have these problems, and one of which is that people don't vote for them. And that sounds like a kind of dumb statement, but if you unpack it, this is what it means. People tend to overwhelmingly identify with one political party or the other and stay with it. And if you just know that, and you know that that more people by a considerable amount are Democrat, stay Democratic than Republican, and then that's stable, you already begin to see what the problem is. The second thing that's related to that is that most people who declare themselves independent, we know this from national surveys, we know this a little bit from Hawaii, and when you look at how they vote, they're not independent in a sense. They lean toward one party or the other. So here that means most independents lean Democratic. So for any given race, any given election, the Republicans start with a numerical disadvantage that is relatively stable. If you had to know nothing else, all this stuff about bad campaigns or candidates, if you had to know nothing else, that's important. And you can see that in the history. Republicans, when Linda Lingle and Charles DeJoux ran for respective offices, they're as good as it's going to get. And they weren't weak candidates. It's the fact that people won't vote for Republicans. And the second thing to understand is that changes in places over time in other parts of the United States. But the change is exceptional. The change is generally very slow. And if you look at the places where it's changed, the so-called revolutionary changes, like what you see going on in, say, in Wisconsin, which is now seen as a conservative state when it used to be very progressive, you know, all it took was a few legislators and a Republican governor to make the change. If you had, you would take much more of a, you know, the legislature here has got at what, 20% of the population. So that to bring about the kinds of changes that have happened in other places, it's not very likely to happen here. And the final thing is that elections of all kinds have become more nationalized. People look to the national parties for cues and national politicians. What that means is that a party like Hawaii's Republican Party, which used to be able to make an argument, we're different, you know, and they didn't always do it very well mm-hmm. because it's hard to do, but you could tightrope walk. We can talk about local issues. That's much harder to do now because people actually pay less attention to that. So all of those things are pretty stable and pretty awesome obstacles. And again, I want to emphasize, it's not about the quality of the candidates. That given this huge obstacle to overcome, you would need an extraordinary candidate. You would need an extraordinary disaster on the part of the Democrats. It's the magnitude of the shift that is so hard. And that's why generally the Republicans don't do well.
Right. So the Republican Party just has a smaller pool to deal with.
Yeah.
And I mean, I recall the days at Honolulu City Council where we saw the candidates there switch parties and they went from Democrats to Republicans and they were recalled.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Then now it's all of a sudden you're seeing
well,
more
now
of
it's
the
nonpartisan.
Republicans. Well, yeah, but you're now yeah. you're seeing all the Republicans are defect to the
yes.
Democratic Party.
Sure. If you, I don't remember any. Any legislative candidate who was a Republican, I mean, who was a Democrat, defecting to the Republicans. And yeah, and the Republicans do it mainly for reasons that it's easier to win. And so there are other things that the Republican Party here could do better. It's almost totally bereft this place of intelligent conservative spokespeople. It's like the party doesn't really have any kind of communications heft, any kind of intellectual heft. But that's more of a symptom than a cause. The fundamental cause is the stability of the way people think about politics and how they vote.
And then I know we've got the Trump factor.
Yeah.
And that was an issue when we talked with the heads of both the GOP and the Democratic Party here. It was more really how are they faring with this whole Trump factor?
Sure. Well, the Trump factor – you know, the party here is so limited in its power that the Trump factor doesn't play out as it does in other places. In a nutshell, this is how the party dealt with Trump. When he first started to run for office, the party, the people who usually speak for the party were dismissive. I remember one of them saying, we're too nice for Trump. He's not going to do well here. Then he wins the caucus. Then there's almost total silence from the Republican bigwigs here during the campaign. And the people who were more likely voting, working for Trump and actively working for Trump were not the real party insiders. Now they're taking a position that we support Trump generally because 80% of the Republicans, 90% of the Republicans voted for Trump. So, but you see that kind of dance, that kind of tightrope that here is reflective of the tough position the Republicans are in.
Right. Okay. So you have money on this election?
I don't. All I say is that remember the way that we missed the probabilities on the Trump election.
Okay. But, All right. Thanks, Neil.
Sure.
We've been talking to political analyst Neil Milner, who has the long view of politics here in the islands. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR1. We'll be right back.
Nick Kurosawa is one of record label Aloha God Soul's newest discoveries. This young soul singer and guitarist brings his original tunes and classic covers to HPR's Atherton Studio on August 18th. Call 955-8821 during office hours or go to hprtickets.org and experience his heartfelt voice in a perfect acoustical setting. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
You could call it the pause that refreshes. That sums up our reality check segment with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Brittany Light joins us this morning. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, thanks for having me, Catherine.
I love your headline, Holy Mackerel, No Tourists in Sight, and the Fish Are Returning to Kauai's North Shore. Talk
it's
about
cute,
that.
Isn't it? Yeah, so local fishermen are saying that one positive result of the April flood, which we know really devastated some of the areas on the North Shore, is that tourists and even a lot of residents are not permitted to go into certain areas right now. So these are places that have some of the island's most popular beaches. And right now the fish are really having a fun time because they're not dealing with people splashing in the water, no sunscreen slicked bodies around. And fishermen are saying they're actually seeing greater numbers of fish really close to the shore.
And the scientists have gone out there too to validate some of that, right?
Yeah, so this knowledge came from the local fishermen, and a couple of scientists flew over from Oahu to see if they could back it with science. And anecdotally, they say they are seeing more fish than they remember seeing there in years past. And their plan is to go back when the road opens and tourists and residents are back in these places and do another study and compare and contrast the numbers.
And I know this is important because they're talking about limiting the number of people down at Haena.
Exactly. So there's already a proposed cap on the number of people who can visit these areas in a given day. Right now, at least 2,000 people on some days are down there, and the cap that's being proposed is 900. So this could be a reinforcement for policies like that.
Right. And I know when we talked to the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Kirk Cottrell was saying, yeah, this might be actually a silver lining because it's giving the resource a chance to kind of rest.
Exactly, exactly. And it turns out fish need that.
Yeah, who knew, right? anything else just about the toll on the reefs that you can add?
Yeah, DLNR is out there trying to map some of the major debris that's been scattered across the reefs, and they're really focusing on items like cars that can cause continuous damage if they're still out there on the reef. So there is a mapping project underway, and they're using satellite technology and all sorts of tools to try to see what's out there and then eventually, you know, try to come up with ways that they can get it out.
Well, I imagine, yeah, that area was pretty icky. You know, the water was brown. There was lots of stuff that kind of just, you know, washed into the water. And there are probably places where maybe you didn't want to go for a while because you don't know what was in that water.
Exactly. It took a long time for those waters to clear up. Lots of sediment and bacteria flushing through there. But now those waters are looking clear and full of fish.
Well, okay. So there's one bright spot to the
exactly.
Flash floods and everything else. All right. Appreciate you checking with us, Brittany.
Yeah, thanks, Catherine.
Okay. We regularly bring you the reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Today we featured a reporter Brittany Light. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org. Smart cities use technology to connect citizens and government. One example is Bandung, the third largest city in Indonesia. The mayor who brought a technology upgrade to the city has just been elected to be the next governor of West Java, the most populous province in the country. Ridwan Kamil is in Honolulu as part of an event at the East-West Center, the Smart Cities Thought Leaders Forum. He talked to Bill Dorman about what it means to be a smart city in 21st century Asia.
In the city of Bandung, for example, if you open a business, you just apply by mobile phone. You don't need to have a long queue.
Don't have to go down to City Hall and wait in the line.
So smart city is basically not only the government service become e-government, for example, but the life of the people also is becoming more connected. Yeah, the thing is about Indonesia, we have a population of 250 million, but mobile phone user is 300 million. So it's a country where the number of mobile phone outnumber the population. And because of everybody has a mobile phone, but not all smartphones, some still old school phone. So now we rely and transform the society to have a better life assisted through the technology of this smart or mobile phones.
How does that work when it comes to resilience? And I'm thinking of Lombok this week and natural disasters and the fact that Indonesia is so many islands, Hawaii in a different way, of course, an island archipelago.
It's very interesting because Indonesia is a country where it has the biggest number of active volcanoes, like in Hawaii, because I think we are in the same more or less situations. So every month or every 3 months, we are experiencing earthquakes, And last one was last Monday, the island of Lombok. So I think I remember that in one volcano disaster, the distribution of helps is way much faster through the Twitter, because back then the Indonesian system of rescue and relief was like, you know, very top down, centralized, so it's really not too very agile. But the volunteer set up the Twitter account, and all people who supporting this effort putting all the data, saying that this area needs blanket, this area needs water, this area needs rice, and so on and so on. So it connected to the whole Indonesia. So the donator or people who wants to help, just checking that account, and they can really give help very detailed, very specific. So they revolutionize the way we communicate in helping the disaster victims.
And you're able to trust that.
It's because it's society by society. For some reason, because the initiative comes from society, so that the level of trust is very high.
You studied architecture and urban planning, UC Berkeley. You do not have a particularly political background. what drew you into the political world?
So my undergraduate architecture in Bandung, but I went to UC Berkeley for my master's degree in urban design. So after 10 years return to my city was in the bad shape. Nobody walks the city. The park was fanned for no reasons. The city was very dirty, corruption. And I said to myself, I had enough. I think I have to take over this so-called Gotham City of Indonesia back then. So I decided to run for a mayor, thanks to Indonesian new democracy. So in order to get elected, you don't have to be the party member. So in Indonesian politics, to get elected, number one, you are the party member. That's very conventional. Number two, you are independent, nominated by independent groups, or you are independent but nominated by party. So I'm the third way. I'm independent. I'm a lecturer, a practicing architect, but nominated by two parties who didn't have the good candidates to compete. So that's what happened. So I bring in the attitude of professional mindset to my bureaucracy. I bring in the scientific mindset to the bureaucracy. So I'm using the smart city. I've been building almost 400 apps You name the problem, we have the apps to solve it. Yeah, because this is how we do it. And after 5 years, before my city was ranked 300 for public service quality, now my city ranked number one in the whole Indonesia, thanks to this connected smart city, transforming the inefficient corruption to city of integrity, city of best public services.
And so now, most recently, you ran for to be leader of the most populous province of Indonesia,
yes.
West Java. Its population is basically about the same as the population of Spain, a little smaller than South Korea. This is a large, large area. And in this election, you face some criticism for not being conservative enough on the religious front. Religion and politics in Indonesia, world's most populous Muslim nation. How did that play a role in the election?
I think the first thing, after 5 years as a mayor, managing 2.5 million people, in the next 4 weeks, I'll be inaugurated as a governor of West Java for almost 50 million. It's like a size of Spain or the size of Australia combined with the size of Malaysia population. I think in politics, anybody can raise issues, yeah. They said I'm not Muslim enough. So, but I fought back and saying that's because you're misinformed.
Speaking about misunderstanding, what do you feel in the United States is most understood about Islam?
I think you have to understand like this. The whole Indonesia, 90% are Muslims. Yeah. So the number of Muslims in the Indonesia is outnumbered the whole Muslim in Middle East. Islam may be born in Middle East, but today, the biggest number of Muslims is Indonesia. And we never got invited by the West to discuss about civilization, to discuss about the West versus Islam or so on. So I think my plea to the United States is in the future, if you want to talk about Islam, please invite Indonesian like me, because we are very moderate Muslims. We embrace your democracy peacefully. Some Western or American democracy couldn't work in Middle East, yeah? In war and, you know. But in Indonesia, we embrace your democracy peacefully. So we are, I win by one man, one vote, yeah. It's Indonesia is popular vote, not like in U.S. you have electoral vote, yeah. Indonesia is really, even the governor of Bali, for example, the previous governor of Bali, won only by eight votes. Yeah, so I think for me, please invite Indonesian because we are representing the majority of Muslim and we are very moderate, very modern. There is no conflict, embracing modernity with keeping the Islamic values. So I think that would be the point.
So speaking of democracy, the current president, Joko Widodo, he was a mayor. You were a mayor. Do you have aspirations for national office?
Jokowi is an inspiration for all mayors. Yeah, because before, in Indonesian history, to become a president of Indonesia of 250 million, either you are the ex-minister in the central government cabinets, or you are the number one person in the political party. But Jokowi was none of them. He was a mayor of a mid-sized city of Solo and moved to Jakarta, the capital, to become a governor for a couple of years, then now become president. So if Jokowi can, I think others, mayor also like me.
Maybe like you. Thanks,
thanks so much. Watch me in 5 years.
we'll have you back. Thank you very much.
Ridwan Kamil is the governor-elect of Indonesia's largest province, West Java, and is in Honolulu as part of the East-West Center's Smart Cities Thought Leaders Forum.
Aloha,
I'm Ed Ebisui. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we remembered a man who gave his name to a Kalihi High School, a street in Lower Manoa Valley, and a highway that runs from Pearl City to the leeward coast of Oahu. He was a Republican who served as the sixth territorial governor of Hawaii from 1921 to 1929. He had been the mayor of Honolulu and editor of both its major daily papers before his early support of presidential candidate Warren Harding led Harding to appoint him to the post. That Kalihi High School's teams are called the Governors in his honor. And by now, you may have a pretty good idea of who we're talking about. This was a man who made his mark in journalism, government, and education. He also served as chairman of the University of Hawaii Board of Regents from 1914 to 1920. We asked you for his name, and it was Wallace Ryder Farrington. Go Governors. But we have no winners today. We stumped you on that one. But that's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, offering flexibility for on-the-go students and families with 24/7 access to Achieve 3000 Hawaii Edition, online or offline. Achieve3000.com.
It's been 4 decades since community groups rallied to preserve the views along East Honolulu Scenic Highway. HPR's Noe Tanigawa joins us following a trek along the Ka'iwi coast earlier this week.
So tell me about this hike you went on.
Right, Ka'iwi Explorations, it's called. Well, it's on that Ka'iwi coastline, which people know, right? It's from Hanauma Bay. You head up and then you're going around. Your eyeballs are relaxing as you go past Bamboo Ridge, then Halona, the blowhole area, then down Sandy Beach. All of that is the Ka'iwi Coast State Scenic Shoreline. And, you know, there was once a development bigger than Ko'olina planned for Sandy Beach area. There was a housing subdivision planned there. There's also a marina and a boat dock and everything. All of a club planned further down the beach. I mean, you can see why, right? This is the first wild area east of Honolulu.
Right. And so it really is incredible that the community was able to protect those scenic views.
It is amazing. And it was secured only 3 years ago. That's 182 acres. 3 years ago, those last mauka parcels, two of them, were secured by a community coalition. I mean, if you look, mauka of the highway, Kalaniana Ole Highway, you can see it right there. It's kind of scrublands with dry grasses, and you see the ridge come up. And this is actually the tail eastern end of the Ko'olau that comes right there, you know, up to Makapu'u Point. And Makai of the highway is what some people call Queen's Beach. It used to be called Allen Davis Beach, too, because of the Davis Ranch, right?
Right.
In that area. And the Davis House, the foundations are still there near kind of a little inlet on the coast. And the home itself was wiped out in a tidal wave that happened in 1946. I mean, I was standing on that shoreline with Kalani Kalima of Waimanalo. He says in the old days, that whole area was called Avavamalu Fishing Village.
Well, the saying is, if you have water, then you plant kalo, taro. If you don't have water, then you plant wala. It was so great over here, this kahua, this area, they would actually send out to the whaling ships. That was the export. They would send out all of the sweet potatoes that they would have because it was so great. Yeah, so this is a thriving fishing village. You know, whenever there was trouble out there, you know, with the fishing fleets, this is where you would find the bodies. Yeah, so Evie's bones. You would find them throughout the coast, and then, you know, you go bury them.
This is the Ka'iwi Coast, but the, you know, rambunctious Ka'iwi channel between Oahu and Molokai there. Kalani Kalima, his ohana and four other Waimanalo families through this giant party. And they really capped that $4 million, you know, price tag to purchase the final two parcels 3 years ago. And in the 3 years, different community groups have gotten together and created this trail so we can get in there and appreciate what it is that we saved here. Avavamalu means shady gulch. So conceivably at one time it was shady there, but you know what it looks like, right? It is dry. It is grassy, scrubby grass, a lot of haolekoa, a little bit of kiawe. This past weekend, we were hiking in this, you know, Moka area. It is scrubby. And on the hike I went on, so lucky, John Hall came along. He's the author of Trailside Plants in Hawaii. And so he was pointing out
nice
this
resource.
And that. Yeah, terrific. Hawaii Trail and Mountain Club help along that hike as well. You know what was neat? He pointed out a plant that looks almost exactly like a haolekoa. And you know those kind of pom-pom flowers?
Mm-hmm. The, yes.
Yeah,
light used to color. Play with those as a kid.
Yeah, right. This is called Acacia Clou, and it's from France. It looks almost exactly like a haolekoa, but those little tufty flower balls are pinkish. And these plants were grown for the perfume industry. So they were brought to Hawaii.
No kidding.
Yeah. And if you know, kiawe even, you smell those flowers, there's a light scent. Look at that Acacia Clou, and it has a really lovely scent. We saw one growing right alongside the other. Haolekoa and this Acacia Clou. And so just look for that pinkish flower and smell it. Ooh, what a sweet smell. So you walk up that rise there. It's not a very difficult trail. It's just up slowly, gradually. A lot of people on this hike this past weekend. And from the left, you see the rise just before the Makapu'u lookout hill. You look down below towards Avavamalu Beach. And over on the right, there's a ridge just before you see the lip of Koko Crater, which is also called Kohe Lepe Lepe. Kohe Lepe Lepe means labia minor or vulva, and it's all part of that epic struggle between Pele and Kamapua'a, the pig god. Kamapua'a was chasing Pele in Kalapana when Pele's sister Kapo lured him away with a vulva, which flew across the islands and landed there at that crater, making an impression on it. As I'm sure this story is making an impression on a lot of people that you'll never forget. You look at the crater and think of this. You know, eventually the vulva lifted itself off and went over to Kalihi. But learning stories like this really make you look at the landscape differently, you know? And that's one of the great things about learning these stories. I was talking with Anne-Marie Kirk. You know her, right? Mm-hmm. She's filmmaker, cultural historian for the Ka'iwi area. She's the founder of MaunaLua.net.
Well, I think knowing place names is so important because it grounds you in where you live. When you hear a place name that's said for over 1,000 years, think of all those people that said that name. And when it comes out of your mouth, you are tied now to that name, to those people. And that's how I feel. I'm grounded with Kupuna in my community here.
It is so cool to learn these stories. And Ka'iwi explorations, those hikes, were just kind of this celebration of and opportunity to learn more about the area.
Yeah, I was just up at the gardens up there, the botanical gardens.
But now, inside the crater.
Yeah, so it's just now interesting to learn that history.
Where you were there,
yes.
Inside the impression of that Kohe Lepe Lepe.
It's a fabulous little garden. If you haven't been, people should go. Just incredible.
It really
cactus
is the plumeria section.
The plumeria section,
fabulous.
Right. Yeah, nice hike.
Well, you know, the community groups that have gotten together for this, let's just take a moment and malama them, say thank you. You folks, Livable Hawaii Kaihui, Ka'iwi Coalition, the Trust for Public Land, the wonderful folks at Sierra Club Oahu, Hawaii Trail and Mountain Club, Ultimate Innovations, Hawaii Kai Golf Course, Kamehameha Schools, Huinalu Canoe Club came out, and
yes,
a whole lot of individual volunteers as well. Because, you know, that Makapu'u Lighthouse hike is the second most popular hike on this island. There's a whole lot of tourism and activity in the area. We have protected the land in terms of development, but vigilance is required with use like
right? The Makapu'u hike, too, the state has done a fabulous job of renovating that trail. It's great. You can go out and overlook that wonderful scenic point. but there's all this great history, too, you can read about.
Yes. Well, I'd be happy to provide a few really terrific websites that have some terrific stories from the area there. And it is so wonderful to learn, to walk the area and learn the stories, because that helps us to cultivate our love for the area. And that is what guides our future decisions.
And that community, like you said, worked long and tirelessly. And I recall, you know, decades ago, that whole initial fight with Save Sandy Beach.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of touched off the whole thing.
Well, people are in those kinds of struggles. So many parts of Hawaii right now. Maybe we should have a little community talk about what works and how these people did it and get some success stories on the table here.
And there's usually a Ka'iwi walk run, I think, too, right?
Right, on the highway?
Yeah,
that's still
marvelous.
Coming up. Oh, I want to do that.
It's very nice. All right, thank you, Noe. Thanks for sharing the stories.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa talking about the history of the Ka'iwi Coast and the contributions of the community's efforts to preserve it.
On Tuesday, August 21st at 6 p.m., join us in the Atherton studio for a conversation with award-winning Lebanese-Egyptian artist, designer, and historian, Bahia Shahab. Ms. Shahab is currently developing a site-specific work as the artist-in-residence at the Shangri-La Museum of Islamic Art, Culture, and Design. Reserve your seat for this free event at hprtickets.org.
HPR fills the, I guess, non-commercial gap that's left by providing a variety of both news and entertainment and quality intellectual programming that you don't see or hear. And I think it provides sort of more truth-telling to the community than you get on many stations. Hi, my name is Bruce McEwen, and I'm a sustaining member of HPR.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, new rules that affect home care workers you should know about. It's an effort to protect our aging population. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call it our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.